Well, then we want to take this compactification of the Teichmüller space. So this is the compactified Teichmüller space. Now, for in general, when you compactify a Teichmüller space, there are lots and lots of ways to do it. But for the punctured torus, all these ways are always going to be the same. So what is this compactification? So the boundary of the compactified Teichmüller space, The boundary of this compactified Teichmüller space, this is naturally identified with the real line union infinity. I'm going to write infinity this way, 1, 0. And, well, for us, what's really going to be important is what this means only for the rational numbers. So what does it mean? So the rationals, Q union 1, 0, this is supposed to be, so we have this identification by picking a basis of the torus. We have this identification between relatively prime pairs of integers and simple closed curves in the torus. Well, that's the same thing as saying we have an identification between rational numbers and simple closed curves in the torus. So the rational points in this boundary correspond to simple closed curves. So you can sort of naturally talk about a point in Teichmüller space limiting off to a simple closed curve. And then the one more thing we need, we have this diagonal. So delta is the diagonal in the boundary, across the boundary. And then we have this theorem of Minsky. So the theorem is there exists a continuous bijection mu from the compactified Teichmüller space, a product of two copies of the compactified Teichmüller space minus the diagonal into the space of hyperbolic three manifolds. Okay? So, and then the theorem that we want to prove is that this is not, so this is very nice, but this is not. So, this is not locally connected. So perhaps it's good to draw a little picture of why it's not a, it's why this map is not even a homeomorphism. So the idea is, well, what's happening? So we have some product space. Okay, so it looks like a product. It's like a box. And we've removed the diagonal from the boundary. Okay, so in our schematic. So this is two real dimension, whereas this is two complex dimensions, but the schematic picture is okay. So this is the real dimensional case, this diagonal is just two points. In our case, the diagonal is more than that. But what's the basic idea? What's happening to the map here? Well, the map looks like so here's an example of a map from that's a bijection. It's a continuous bijection, but it's not a homeomorphism. So as we go off to this in the domain, as we go off to this point in the diagonal, we leave the space. But over here, we converge. So that's the basic problem that's happening. Okay, and so as I said this morning, this construction of Anderson Canary shows that this map can't be continuous. And then McMullen actually showed that the picture sort of looks like the picture I've drawn here, that it's this space self-bumps. All right. So let's talk a little bit about what this map is. So let's say we take two points in Teichmuller space, not in the boundary. Then what is nu of xy? Well, nu of xy is supposed to be some sort of hyperbolic 3-manifold. This hyperbolic 3-manifold is going to be homeomorphic to the punctured torus across the real line, and it's going to be one of these quasi-Fuchsian manifolds. And the conformal boundary on one side is going to be x, and the conformal boundary on the other side is going to be y. All right, now what happens when we take rational numbers? So P and Q and R after some rational numbers. Well, then what happens here is that nu of PQ RS, well, it's going to be a bit harder for me to draw, but okay, well, the top and the bottom look the same, but they're not supposed to be. So in the top, well, let's say on the bottom, the PQ curve is supposed to be pinched, and on the top, the RS curve is supposed to be pinched. So in this representation, we have two parabolics, one corresponding to the PQ curve and one corresponding to the RS curve, and there's also some order. One is on the bottom and one is on the top. If I switch the order around, then the RS would be on the bottom and the PQ would be on the top. Okay, now it's possible to mix these two behaviors. I could have something in the interior of Teichmuller space, and then I could have some rational number on the boundary of Teichmuller space, and then I'd have something pinched on one side, and I have a conformal structure on the other. It's also possible to have non-rational numbers, right? Irrationals are part of this boundary. Those don't really, I'm not going to talk about those. I'm going to ignore them. Those are, in terms of proving this theorem, it's these points that are correspond to irrational numbers that are the tricky ones. But we'll ignore that for. And in terms of proving this theorem, it's the rational ones where the interesting stuff happens. Okay, so I want to look at the next thing I want to do is I want to look at a subspace of this space of representation. And the subspaces I'm going to look at is I'm going to pinch one curve. And the curve I pick doesn't really matter, but just to make life easier, I'm going to pinch the. So I want to look at something called the Maskin slice, and what this is going to be. This is going to be the set of representations in AH of the punctured torus where the second coordinate is the point infinity on the boundary. It's the point 1, 0. So the Maskin slice, so this is the image of T, or well, let's say T hat cross 1, 0 in AH. So what this means is that this 1, 0 curve is parabolic. Well, what is the 1, 0 curve? So let's do one other identification. I said that the fundamental group I've given the fundamental group a name here. I've given it two generators, A and B. Let's let A be the 1, 0 curve and B be the 0, 1 curve. So I picked a basis for, say, the homology of the punctured torus. Okay, so now I can write down explicitly what these representations look like. Okay, so this is just a little exercise in playing around with PSL2C. So let's call this set M. This is M for masked slice. And we have the following facts. So here are the facts. Every representation in M is conjugate to a representation rho mu, where rho mu of A is equal to I mu is equal to the following matrix, and rho mu of B is equal to just the standard parabolic. This is very concrete. I mean, how do you prove something like this? Well, I have a representation. I know that B is parabolic. Well, all parabolics are conjugate. All parabolics in PSL2C are the same. So I just conjugate it to this particular parabolic. And then, well, that takes away one of my degrees of freedom. I still have two more degrees of freedom. And what I do next is I conjugate, so I can pick the fixed points of this next element. And I can just check directly that, I can check what the trace of this next element is, and then I can conjugate it so that you can just check directly that you can conjugate your other element to this particular representative. Okay, so what have we done here? This gives us something called the masked embedding of Teichmuller space. Okay, so if we have some representation, rho in M, we know that rho is conjugate to some rho mu, and then we can define a map from M into C, which takes rho to mu. Okay, so this is called the masked embedding. Of the Teichmuller space. And the reason why this is an embedding of Teichmuller space, well, let's look at this. So this, well, at least if I just take the interior, this set is just naturally isomorphic to the Teichmuller space of the punctured torus. So this construction gives me an embedding of the Teichmuller space of the punctured torus into the plane. Why would we do that? Well, we'll hopefully see later why we do that. But the thing to notice here is that if I look at all these representations, they're always going to be representations of this free group, right? And they're also always going to have the property, you can just check, that if I take the commutator of A and B, that the representation on that commutator is going to be a parabolic element. You can just directly check that. But what won't happen is this representation will not always be a nice discrete and faithful representation. Sometimes it will lie in AH. Other times it will just be an indiscrete, nasty-looking representation. So you can actually draw pictures of what this embedding looks like. And the picture you get is something like this. It looks sort of like a... It's some sort of modified upper half plane. Right? The Teichmuller space of the punctured torus is the upper half plane. Well, this looks sort of like an upper half plane since the boundary has become sort of a fractal. So what are some things you can notice? One thing you can notice is that from now on, I'm going to skew the... So M is going to be a subset of AH, and it's also going to be a subset of the plane. I'm going to abuse my notation here. So one thing you can notice is that if mu is in M, that means mu plus 2 is also in M. This is pretty easy to check, because you can see that if I replace mu with mu plus 2, well, the image of the representation is the same. So notice that if you take rho mu of B times A, that's just I mu plus 2. So you have this nice periodicity, which is going to be very important later. The other thing to observe is, how might you draw a picture of this set M? Well, the way you draw a picture of M is you draw a picture of the boundary. And how might you draw a picture of the boundary? Well, what does it mean? What happens if I take a rational number in the boundary here? What does that mean? That means that not only is the curve B parabolic, but the curve corresponding to that rational number is parabolic. So you get an equation, right? You take this representation, you have this variable mu, and you try and solve for when this new element on the boundary is parabolic. And you'll get some polynomial equation, and you solve that polynomial equation, and you get a bunch of answers. Some of them are going to correspond to indiscrete representations, but one of them won't. It's going to lie in the boundary. So you do this for lots and lots of different rational numbers, and you get sort of a picture of dots, and what it does is it fills out the complement of this set M. And one thing that you can check pretty easily is that the boundary of this set M cannot be a straight line. So the boundary of M is not a horizontal line. You can just calculate this directly. And this is going to be one of the main things we need to know. Let's make one more observation about this set M. Well, what happens if I replace mu by negative mu or by mu bar? Well, again, you could check and you could see that if mu is in the masked slice, then I replace it by mu bar or negative mu, I'm going to again get a discrete faithful representation. But what's going to happen in that representation, and this requires a bit of thought, is that the cusp, instead of being, so the cusp should be on top. If the imaginary part of mu is negative, then the cusp will be in the bottom. So just looking at the algebra, you can't, you know, the representation isn't going to really pick out where the cusp is on the top or the bottom. You have to think a little bit about the geometry. And that's also going to be an important fact. So here, let's write this down. If mu is an M, and this implies that negative mu bar, that these are also discrete, are in the image. So we flip it around. The cusp is on the bottom instead of being on the top. Okay, so we have this very, in this case of the puncture torus, things are really nice, very concrete, and you can write things down. So it may seem that everything I'm doing is completely dependent on the puncture torus, but it's actually, that's not quite true. There are going to be key points where you really are using the factor in the puncture torus, but there's also a lot of this that works in greater generality. Okay, so what's the next thing we need to do? The next thing we need to do is we need to... What is the fundamental domain? So, let's see, maybe here's one way to do it. So, if one thinks about it, there is only one triply punctured sphere group. They're all conjugate, right? So if you have a triply punctured sphere group, they're always conjugate. Right? So this is it's always conjugate to a nice Fuchsian group. Okay? And if you play around with the generators here, you can see that that group, there is some particular triply punctured sphere group that always lies inside of here. And what happens is that this new element, what it's doing is it's gluing together two of these cusps in this triply punctured sphere group. It's gluing together two of these cusps, and then you get one of these punctured torus groups. So this is your cusp of your punctured torus, and this is gluing up to give you so you're identifying these cusps, and now this becomes a torus. I don't have them on me, but yeah, certainly you can find them on the web. Does he have limits? I'm sure if you go to McMullen's website, there are pictures of it. Although, to be honest, I think if you're looking at a limit set of a quasi-Fuchsian group, I have no way of telling you whether it's a punctured torus group or whether it's a genus 18 surface. I mean, I don't think looking at the limit set itself is... Yeah. So what's the limit set going to... I mean, it's... What is topologically the limit set's going to look? It's a circle, but then you've collapsed this... this lamination. So, Jeff may have some pictures on his website too. They're probably not of this particular type of group, but something similar. Well, what's the definition of alpha? What's the other point? The other point is, in this particular case, the limit set is going to be made out of round circles. Yeah, that's right. The limit set is going to be made around circles because, and this is actually, let's see, this is related to sort of an important fact. The boundary of the convex core on the cusp side is always going to be a totally geodesic, triply punctured sphere. And this is, again, because there is only one triply punctured sphere. Whenever you have a Kleinian group that has conformal boundary, a triply punctured sphere, the corresponding convex core boundary is always a totally geodesic, triply punctured sphere. Okay, so what do I want to do next? I want to do a little bit more topology. So I want to define a three-manifold, and what that three-manifold is going to be, it's going to be our punctured torus. It's going to be a bundle over the punctured torus minus, we're going to drill out this 1-0 curve, minus W and W. This is going to be a tubular neighborhood of the... of the curve, of the 1-0 curve cross, well, this is terrible notation, of tubular neighborhood of the 1-0 curve. So think of the 1-0 curve as lying on the torus cross a half, and then take a small tubular neighborhood of it and remove it. What's the fundamental group of this manifold? Okay, well, it's going to have three generators. I'm going to call them A, B, and C. And the idea is, well, if B is supposed to correspond to the 1-0 curve, C is the new element, and the thing, so B and C are supposed to generate the fundamental group of this boundary torus, the boundary of W. So the condition you need is you need their commutator. You need these two things to commute. So this is just an exercise in Siefert Van Kampen's theorem. Okay, so we have this manifold with this curve removed. And notice these manifolds, they sort of look like our original manifolds, right? They have our original manifolds in AH of T, at least the ones in the interior, the quasi-Fuchsian ones, what do they have? They have these two boundary components consisting of these two conformal structures. So the idea is there's sort of a way of identifying these manifolds with quasi-Fuchsian manifolds in AH of T. All right. So yeah. So what's the next step? The next step to do is to take these representations and extend them to representations of pilot of M hat. And how do I do that? Well, if I want to extend this representation to a representation of pi 1 of m hat, I need to define it on C. Okay. And I also need for it to commute with B. Okay, what is everything that commutes with this element, this matrix right here, 1, 2, 0, 1? Well, the only things that commute with it are 1, beta, 0, 1. I can change this 2 to any complex number I want, but that's all I can do. So we define a representation rho mu of beta by rho mu beta of A equals rho mu of A, rho mu beta of B equals rho mu of B, and rho mu beta of C, 1 beta 0 1. Okay, so now I want to do something similar to what I did with the master plus. I want to take these, look at these representations, and I want to say, well, for what values of beta is this going to be in AH of M hat? So let's see. So I'm going to define the following set. A of mu, this is going to consist of beta in C such that the imaginary part of beta is bigger than 0. This is just a normalization. If you look at these representations, if you replace beta with negative beta, you basically get the same representation. Let's see. So I want the imaginary part of beta to be greater than 0, and I want rho mu of beta to be in the interior of AH of M hat. And I'm going to add one more point to this. I'm going to add the point infinity. So we want to think of this set A mu. This is supposed to lie inside. This is supposed to lie inside the Riemanns here. Okay. So we'll see why in a second I'm doing this. But all right, so for each mu in the Masket slice, we can do this construction, and then we can look at what happens. So now I'm going to define a set A, which is going to lie inside of C cross C hat, and this is going to be exactly pairs mu beta, such that mu is in the Masket slice, and beta is in the set A mu. Okay, so now here, what is the point of this? So this is sort of the main work in this whole procedure here. There exists a local homeomorphism, psi, from A onto So the map A is going to take, we're going to map our space A to the space of quasi-Fuchsian punctured torus groups. This is the interior of AH of T, and this Masket slice on the boundary. So here again, I'm abusing notation. Now the Masket slice is a set of representations, not a subset of C. Okay. So I have this local homeomorphism, and what is this? What's the point of this? The point of this is that then, okay, what's step two? Step two, there exists mu in M such that the point mu infinity, such that A is not locally connected at mu infinity. Okay, so if you combine these two statements, you prove that this space is not locally connected, which is a subset of AH. It's a pretty big subset of AH. And you need to work a little bit more to see that all of AH is not locally connected. And this is actually the main place where you use that we're dealing only with punctured torus groups and not in the more general setting. I'm not going to say anything about that, but yeah. So there's another step there to get the whole theorem. Okay, so what is this map? Let's describe what this map is. Yeah, so what I want to do is I'm going to describe what this map is and then prove this last theorem. This is sort of fun. Yes? The what? How did I define it? I guess strictly speaking, it should be the interior. Not quite sure if it matters. Okay, so how does this work? So let's imagine we have one of these drilled three manifolds, rho, mu, beta. Okay, so it's an I bundle, and then I put a little X in here to indicate that we've removed a curve. This is how we draw these pictures. So this is some rho, mu, beta, where mu beta is in A, and let's assume that beta is not infinity. That case we'll deal with separately. Okay, so what does it mean to have one of these representations? What does a three-manifold look like? Well, it's going to be a nice geometrically finite three-manifold, and its conformal boundary is going to consist of conformal structures X and Y. Well, this is almost the same kind of information that you use to define a element in the undrilled manifold, an actual quasi-Fuchsian manifold, right? What do you need? You need two conformal structures. But you also need a marking of them. You need a canonical identification with a fixed copy of the punctured torus. And we don't quite have that as we stand now. So what we need to do to define this map, we need to figure out exactly how we want to mark these by the punctured torus. So how can we do that? Well, what do we have? Okay, so over here, we have the hyperbolic three-manifold rho mu. Okay. This is just a subgroup of this. So this is something in the masked slice that's got this one cusp down here. And there's some covering map from here to here. And if you want, you can think, well, this is supposed to be a marked manifold, so I wasn't careful enough, I didn't leave enough space. There's a map of a torus into here, sort of the marking map. And then there's a covering map from this manifold into here. So we have a map of the torus into this manifold. Now, what does that map look like? The key point here is that map may not be what you think it is. So the first guess might be that the image of this torus just is some torus that lies, say, below the drilled out curve. So that's one possibility. But it's not the only possibility. It may also be that this torus wraps around the drilled out curve. In either case, in this drilled manifold, the torus is not homotopic to both x and y. So we can't use this torus to mark x and y, because this drilled curve is an obstruction. To be able to mark x and y, we need to fill this thing back in. We need to do Dane filling. And yeah, notice if it's wrapped, we're not homotopic to either x and y. Okay, so the next thing we want to do is we want to do a topological construction. I want to take this drilled manifold and I want to fill it in. And I want to just fill it in topologically, because when I fill it in topologically, I'll be able to do my homotope my torus here down to x and down to, and up to y. And then I'll be able to mark these two conformal structures. And that will define my point in quasi-Fuchsian space. So the marking is really, really important here. You know, lots of times you just sort of can forget it. Here it's very important. So what do I have? So here, this map is a marking map, this is the covering map, and this is a Dane filling map. So then we're going to fill. But remember, when we do Dane filling, we have to pick the curve we're going to fill along. So how do we do that? Well, there's a canonical way to do that. And that is, we fill along the curve C. C corresponds to some curve on the torus, and that's the one we're going to fill on. So we fill C. And this gives us... So when we do this... Now this is homeomorphic to the punctured torus across the interval. This is the fact I was saying this morning. We've done sort of like a one-end Dane filling. Well, I started with a drilled manifold. I didn't really drill anything out. I mean, I just that's what I started with. Yeah. Okay. I don't know. Yeah, no, it's not. It is topologically, it's the same thing. I mean, what? Yeah, I mean, there's some sort of funny topology going on here. The identification of the fundamental group. So I've given this representation of the fundamental group. So the identification of the this presentation of the fundamental group with M hat is changing. It's not always the same. I mean, there's just sort of a fact. If I have a representation of this fundamental group, so there's a fact, you know, that you're always going to get a manifold that looks like this. But the thing you don't know is how the restriction of that representation to the group generated by A and B, how it's going to lie in the manifold. It's going to change. Sometimes it will be embedded, sometimes it will correspond to these wrapped representations. I mean, looking at these wrapped representations, this is sort of the original Anderson Canary construction, and this is sort of, I mean, it all really goes back then. Okay, so now I filled, and this isn't necessarily a hyperbolic manifold anymore. It's just a topological construction, but now this possibly ugly image of the punctured torus, well, the first thing to notice is it's going to be a homotopy equivalent. If you compose all these maps, we're going to have a homotopy equivalent from the punctured torus into here. And what that tells us is that we can homotome this marking map down to x and to y. So this determines a quasi-Fuchsian group. Okay, so that's what happens if beta is not infinity. So this is, so I'll write down, you know, so phi of nu beta is just nu of x, y. Where x, I'm not writing it down, and I should, x now also has this marking that I've defined. It's really important to keep track of it. Okay, and what do we do in the case when beta is infinity? Well, there's really only one thing we could do, and that is we'll just map this to rho mu. This is the point in the mask slice. So there's something to observe about this map, and that is it's infinite to one onto quasi-Fuchsian space. You can take some manifolds of conformal boundary X and Y. I mean, you could sort of do this backwards. You could, well, maybe not backwards, but you could start in the middle. I could take some manifold, drilled manifold with boundary X and Y. And then I could figure out what my representation is by just putting in, so I could go backwards, I could put in my surface in different ways. I could wrap it once, I could wrap it twice, I could wrap it three times. Each time, I'll get a different representation. But over here, I'll always get the same image. So the map is infinite to one onto quasi-Fuchsian space, but it's one-to-one onto the Maskew place. So it's pretty bizarre. Okay, so that's the construction of the map. I want to talk about this next, and then I'll, at the end, if I have time, I'll come back. Ooh, I don't think I will, but I'll come back to why that's a local homeomorphism. Oh, because the only things that are mapped in the Maskew place is when we have an infinity there. And, I mean, right, so what is this set A? If I restrict this set A, if I look at infinity, if I restrict the second quarter to be infinity, what A is, it's just a copy of the Maskew place. I mean, the only point that's mapped to rho mu is mu infinity. Okay, so now how do we tell if a group, if one of these representations, mu beta, is a nice discrete faithful representation? So when is rho mu beta in AH or in the interior? Okay, what's one condition? What's one necessary condition? Well, a necessary condition is that every single subgroup has to be discrete and faithful. So the restriction of rho mu beta to the group generated by C to the negative NA B must be discrete and faithful, right? If you look at any subgroup, you should still get a discrete faithful representation. Well, what is this? Rho mu beta of C to the negative N A, this is equal to what does this look like? This is just one of these first. This is just a Maskew place representation. This is going to be a discrete faithful representation if and only if mu minus n beta is in the Maskew place or the negative of it is. Okay. So this gives us an infinite collection of necessary conditions to check. Sort of seems like a bummer. But it turns out that we don't really need to check all of these infinite conditions. We really, not yet. So it turns out that not only that this infinite set of necessary conditions, it actually turns out we can just look at two of them, and they're also sufficient. So what do? Well, what I'm going to do is there's going to be a unique N. There's a unique N such that the imaginary part of mu N beta is greater than 0, and the imaginary part of mu minus n plus 1 beta is less than 0. Remember, the imaginary part of beta is positive. So at some point, this is going to go from having positive imaginary part to negative imaginary part. All right, now if, so what happens? So if mu minus n beta is an m, and mu minus n plus 1 beta, or the complex conjugate of it is an m, then what does our group look like? What does the representation look like? Well, we can construct it by hand. So what is this? This one is this element here gives me a representation where the cusp is on the top. Draw a little schematic picture. This element here gives me a representation where the cusp is on the bottom. Okay, so I can take these two manifolds, and I can remove, you know, so remember what I was saying earlier. Whenever you have a triply punctured sphere, the convex core is bounded by a totally geodesic triply punctured sphere. Okay? So I can take this boundary of the convex core here and the one here, and I can glue them together. And I get a nice, complete hyperbolic 3-manifold. And then I can check, and I can see that hyperbolic 3-manifold that I built is exactly rho mu beta. So these two necessary conditions are also sufficient. So now we can draw a picture. Now we can draw a picture of the set A mu. So what does it look like? So let's draw, here's a picture of A mu. Okay, so what happens if beta is has a very, very large imaginary part in relation to the imaginary part of mu? If beta has a very large imaginary part, then the n here is going to be 0. And what happens when n is 0? When n is 0, the first condition is always satisfied, right? Mu, by definition, is an m. Yeah, when n is 0, this condition is always satisfied. What about the second condition? When is the second condition satisfied? Well, basically, it's satisfied when this holds. What does this mean? This condition basically, what it tells us is the set of values with n is 0 is basically homeomorphic to a copy of the Maskett slice. So one piece of our set, A mu, is just going to look like some translated version of the Maskett slice. Okay, so now as beta gets smaller, I mean, and you could, what our n is depends only on what the imaginary part of beta is. So as n, so okay, so beta gets smaller, so we get to the point where n has to be 1. Now we have two conditions to check. We need this to be in the Maskett slice, and we need this to be in the Maskett slice. So what if you think about this, what you see is that the case when n equals 1, it's going to be the set is going to be the intersection of two copies of the Maskett slice. One is going to be facing up, this one is going to be facing up, and this one is going to be facing down. It's the intersection of these two copies of the Maskett slice. Now, that intersection may be empty, like one copy may be way up here and one copy may be way down here. But if you choose things carefully, you'll get a definite intersection. So, you know, the other part of the picture may look something like this. Okay, well, now here's where we use the fact that the boundary of the Maskett slice is not a horizontal line. So if we choose this carefully, we can make it so that this intersection looks like this. These two things overlap. And when we do this, the key point is we can find, so there exists mu such that A mu has bounded components. And this just follows from the fact that the Maskell place is not bounded by a horizontal line. That's all, the only thing we're using to get this fact. Okay, what's the other observation we want to make? Well, the other observation we want to make is that A mu is translation invariant. If beta is in A mu, then beta plus 2 is in A mu. This is the same as the reason for the Maskell place. If you replace the beta with beta plus 2, your image representation is exactly the same. Okay, so what do we have here? We have this set, mu. It's translation invariant, but it has bounded components. Okay, so, well, our components are sort of nasty looking, but let's just draw them like disks. So it has these components. Well, once it has one bounded component, it has to have an infinite number. Okay, well, what does that tell us? Well, now let's look at this picture at infinity. What does the point at infinity look like? So here we are in the Riemann sphere, and we look at the point at infinity. Well, these components are going to, the fact that we have bounded components here is going to force A mu to not be locally connected at infinity. So these things are coming in, you know, they're getting smaller and smaller. You have this sort of infinite family of islands converging to the point at infinity. So the point is, this implies that A mu is not locally connected at infinity. Is which set connected? The whole space is connected, that's right. But the slice is disconnected, right. It is disconnected, right. But the whole space is connected. Well, okay. So the interior of the whole space is not connected. It has an infinite number of components. So the interior of the space is an example of one of these manifolds that has an infinite number of different marked homeomorphism types. That's what's happening. Yeah, what is happening? So I think this is the picture that I So you can see the phenomenon by looking at, so this is two complex dimensions, but you can look at what's happening in two real dimensions. So let's look at a set in R2 that is translation invariant. Well, the Maskell place it's going to look like I'm drawing the Maskell place again because, so what's the one? So we have some set in R2 that's translation invariant. And what we're doing, so if I was in C, what I've done is I've compactified one of the directions by making C into C hat, okay, or C into CP1, if you want to think of it that way. I can do the same thing here. I can compactify one of the, so here's my space. I can compactify one of the directions by making R into RP1. Well, then what happens? Well, then this R2 becomes a cylinder. And what happens to this set? Well, so here is this line at infinity that I've added. Let's draw it in front so you can see it. And then what happens to this set is that these bumps, what looks evenly spaced about, start accumulating. And it's not locally connected at the end. And my slices, what do my slices look like? My slices look like, you know, the intersection of the green line with... Okay, so there's one other thing we should notice here, and that is that, well, I've shown that A mu is not locally connected. I haven't really shown that all of A is not locally connected. But it's not hard to go from one to the other. As we perturb mu, the picture really isn't going to change very much. So the picture basically looks like a product. You know, and if I take a little neighborhood of the mu plane, it's going to essentially look like a product. And, you know, you could, going from this to showing that A is not locally connected is not too tricky. Okay, well, it looks like I'm out of time. Let's see. So, the parts that are specific to the punctured torus. This masking slice is particular to the punctured torus. It's a very concrete object. If you look at higher genus surfaces, instead of looking at masking slices, you would sort of have a family of masking slice-like things. And you would need to make the same analysis that these objects weren't bounded by horizontal lines. The other thing that's really, the place where you really, really use the punctured torus is going from quasi-Fuchsian space union to some of the points in the boundary to the whole boundary. And the point there is that the end lamination classification in this case is pretty nice. The end invariants have this nice topology, and the map from the space of end invariants to AH is at least continuous. In a higher genus, that's not the case. There is no topology on the end invariants, and that's, I think, going to be a trickier issue to deal with.